What's my subscription to the New York Times have me doing this week? Preparing a strawberry pretzel pie. Solving spelling bee with no hints. Planning a trip to one of the 52 best places to go. Getting to the bottom of the big pants trend.
Whoa.
And I'm finally replacing my vacuum with a recommendation I can trust. What will your subscription to the Times have you do? Why not find out? With our best offer, go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, the Arab world says President Trump just sabotaged the chance of peace between Israel and the Palestinians. But had the Arab world given up on the Palestinians long ago? And a visit with the new crown prince of Saudi Arabia. It's Thursday, December 7th.
Thank you. When I came into office, I promised to look at the world's challenges with open eyes and very fresh thinking. We cannot solve our problems by making the same failed assumptions and repeating the same failed strategies of the past. All challenges demand new approaches.
And what was the reaction throughout the Arab world to this announcement from President Trump?
It is time to officially recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel.
That the U.S. now considers Jerusalem to be the capital of Israel and will move our embassy there.
It's something that has to be done.
Well, in a word, horror.
Anne Bernard is the Beirut bureau chief for The Times.
What we've seen is
America just opened the gates of hell.
Unanimous condemnation from all corners of the Arab and Muslim world.
Because this is, if anything, a declaration of war against the Palestinian people and their rights in their homeland.
Every single U.S. diplomatic post across the Muslim world right now is bracing for the impact, potential violence, and what will undoubtedly be an impact on foreign policy.
We've heard from the King of Jordan saying that this is going to be a blow to any hopes for settlement in the Middle East and that it can destabilize the whole region. We've heard from President Erdogan of Turkey that Jerusalem is a red line for all Muslims all over the world. And you have leaders that really disagree with each other on a lot of other things, sounding the same note here.
Iran's President Hassan Rouhani said earlier today that Iran will show no tolerance towards the arrogant power's aggression towards Islamic sanctities. And by arrogant powers, he's referring to the United States and Israel.
You have Iran coming out and declaring that this is a case of global arrogance, that this is a sign of desperation on the part of the United States for its other failures in the region.
We've already started to see protests on the streets in Gaza and Palestinian groups calling for a so-called day of rage.
And at the same time, you have Saudi Arabia, which considers itself an archenemy of Iran, saying that this is a step that is dangerous for the region.
The consequences of this on the long term for the United States in the Middle East, in the wider Middle East, is going to be disastrous.
President Trump is not only encouraging violence, he is provoking violence. He is also provoking a religious war.
Right, we're talking about such a diverse group of countries in the Middle East. Jordan, Iran, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, countries with lots of different and competing interests. Why does this issue unite all of these countries?
Jerusalem. This ancient city lies at the very heart of the Israel-Palestinian conflict.
Because Jerusalem has been important in the Arab imagination and the Muslim imagination for centuries, since the Crusades, the struggle over control of the Holy Land as a place that is believed to be where the Prophet Muhammad rose up to heaven. Mm-hmm. But it's more than that. It's also a cultural touchstone. You know, Palestinians that have been dispersed throughout the region without a state dream of having a Palestinian state.
Palestinian officials who want to see East Jerusalem as their own capital as part of any two-state solution that would serve as the foundation of a lasting peace with the Israelis are outraged.
So the idea of the Palestinian cause has been the uniting factor in a region that has many disputes and disagreements.
Recognition of the capitals was always supposed to be a final step, the end of negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians, the conclusion of a peace process, not a way to get it started.
It seems to me, Anne, that another thing that all these Arab countries have in common is a deep suspicion of the U.S. claiming to be a mediator in this, but really being on the side of Israel. Does this move by the Trump administration basically seem to confirm to these countries that, in a sense, they've been right all along? Is that what this is kind of all about?
Absolutely. And you have to keep in mind that there's a long history to these negotiations. So the Palestinians have given up various aspirations in the course of decades of talks. And when they decided to embrace the idea of a Palestinian state alongside Israel and give up the aspiration of somehow taking over all of Israel and calling it Palestine, you know, there was an understanding that in exchange for that, there was a solid commitment that they would have East Jerusalem as a capital. And to suddenly be confronted with the possibility that that might not be the case, it calls into question so many of the compromises that were made in the past. This is almost like just a blow that nobody was expecting would go this far.
So now that President Trump has more or less confirmed this suspicion that these Arab countries have harbored for so long, what are we expecting these nations to do now in reaction?
Well, they're all issuing statements and condemnations, and there will be meetings, and there will probably be street protests. But at the same time, people are doubting that Arab leaders or Arab countries or even the broader Muslim world will come together to really do anything about this. I mean, it doesn't seem that they can, and it's not clear that it's even the top priority anymore for governments, even though they will issue rhetorical statements.
So what you're saying is they might not do all that much at all beyond express anger.
That's right. Once upon a time, the Palestinian cause seemed like the most urgent and the most important issue for all these countries. But now it's fallen down on the list.
It was frustration at Tunisia's youth unemployment that started it all.
These governments are worried about their own stability after the Arab revolts that started 7 years ago.
People came out and dared to denounce their government, defying the riot police sent to confront them. Some rulers have gone, others survived. Some countries are still in turmoil.
There are wars in Iraq, in Syria, in Yemen.
Yemen is now gripped by a civil war between several factions. The main struggle is between the Houthis and the president they deposed last year.
There is a contest between Saudi Arabia and Iran over dominance in the region. There is economic stagnation and the lack of political freedoms that continue to put pressure on these regimes.
Arab regimes across the region have failed. On economically, politically, on the security front, they have failed to form a regional structure, any form of permanent prosperity or stability.
So, you know, there's just somehow Palestine is no longer at the top of the agenda for a lot of these leaders.
So at some point, these Arab countries stopped thinking of Palestinians and a Palestinian state as the most urgent thing in their world.
That's right.
So does that then mean, Anne, that all this talk of the president's decision to move the embassy derailing a peace plan is somehow missing a larger point?
Well, yes. The first larger point it's missing is that there really is no credible peace process going on right now and hasn't been for years. So in a way, it just ratifies the lack of a peace process. And at the same time, it's also going to expose the fact that countries all over the region who were supposed to be backing the Palestinians in that process are completely distracted with their own issues. This is a real test case of whether there will be any real action from the Arab neighbors. I mean, certainly this is as deeply felt a moment as one could imagine for Palestinians.
Mm-hmm.
We spoke to one Palestinian, and this is interesting. He said, you know what, quote me today as a Palestinian citizen living in a refugee camp in southern Beirut. And he said, you know, I'm 47 years old. I haven't seen Jerusalem in my life. My father left Palestine when he was 9. I'm attached to every single bit of the soil in Palestine. And he said, all the Palestinians should rise up on behalf of this sleepy Arab world. He was holding out hope that maybe, maybe the passionate response of Palestinians themselves would wake up the rest of their allies.
So this is a Palestinian having the pure reaction of someone who feels that he has lost some claim on what he believes to be the capital of a future Palestinian state, wondering if his Arab neighbors will actually do anything about it.
Right. Wondering if they'll even care.
And thank you very much.
And thank you.
We'll be right back.
My name is Jasmine Ulloa, and I'm a national politics reporter for The New York Times. I grew up in Texas, on the border with Mexico, and I've been reporting in the region since I was in high school. Now I travel the country looking for stories and voices that really capture what immigration and the nation's demographic changes mean for people. What I keep encountering is that voters don't fall into neat ideological boxes on this very volatile issue. There's a lot of gray. And that's where I feel the most interesting stories are. I'm trying to bring that complexity and nuance to our audience, especially in such a critical election year. And that's really what all of my colleagues on the politics team and every journalist at the New York Times is aiming to do. Our mission is to help you understand the world, no matter how complicated it might be. If you want to support this mission, consider subscribing to the New York Times. You can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Saudi Arabia's heir to the throne has been making bold political moves, which many consider to be unprecedented.
His government has allegedly detained both the president of Yemen and the Lebanese prime minister, and there's even talk of Saudi Arabia joining with Israel to attack Iran.
Saudi-led coalition has launched airstrikes targeting Shia Houthi rebels who took power in a coup in February.
Last June, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Bahrain and Egypt cut ties with Qatar and imposed a land, sea and air blockade, setting off an unprecedented crisis in the Gulf region.
Arrests in Saudi Arabia widely seen as a move by the Crown Prince to consolidate his power.
Saudi Arabia's 32-year-old Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, has quickly established himself as the most powerful figure in the Arab world, rushing into domestic and foreign confrontations that have left American officials worried he's destabilizing the region, and human rights activists alleging he's created a humanitarian crisis in Yemen. But it's another set of actions taken by the prince that has caught the attention of my colleague, Thomas Friedman, a foreign affairs columnist.
So I interviewed him 2 years ago, and I interviewed him a year ago, so I've had a relationship with him. And when I saw all this, I emailed the Saudi embassy in Washington and said I'd be very interested in coming to Saudi Arabia to better understand this.
And so tell me about your actual meeting with the Crown Prince. Where did you actually meet him?
So the way this works there is you wait around all day for the call from the palace, and they then send a car for you because you can't, like, take an Uber over to the palace. In my case, this happened about 9:30 at night.
Wow.
And his palace is in a neighborhood in North Riyadh called Ouja. He received me in his reception room. And we first just sat around and schmoozed. And then he said, let's do the interview. And so we go into his big diwan or sitting room, and he took a seat in the center. I took the seat next to him. And then all his aides were sitting on the couches in the background. And he just basically said, fire away.
So what did you want to ask him about?
The big thing going on in Saudi Arabia right now, which you simply cannot exaggerate its importance, okay, is the fact that this crown prince has been willing to reverse the far-right turn that Islam took in 1979. I started my time as a reporter in the Middle East, in Beirut, in 1979. I covered two major stories that year. One was the takeover of the Grand Mosque in Mecca by radical, puritanical Saudi fundamentalists.
In Mecca, men described as religious deviants are holding hostages in the sacred Grand Mosque.
15,000 pilgrims were praying at dawn.
500 of these people, at the height of the Hajj, come to the Grand Mosque in Mecca carrying coffins. They open the coffins, they pull out submachine guns, and they begin shooting up the Grand Mosque of Mecca. They take over the Grand Mosque for 2 weeks. From the heights of the mosque, they broadcast the Saudi ruling family. You are corrupt. You have abandoned Islam. You have bought into Western secularism. You have no right to be the rulers of the two holy mosques. You have completely just abandoned the right path. So in the wake of that event, the Saudi ruling family freaked out. A process of reform and opening that had been going on there was completely stopped. The religious police became utterly empowered, and Saudi Arabia begins exporting the most puritanical, fundamentalist form of Islam all across the Muslim world, from Morocco to the border of India, and Islam in 1979 loses its brakes.
You should all say death to the Shah. Say death to the Shah.
And that wasn't all that happened in 1979.
Fundamentalism took hold with a fury and a force that helped ignite the still impoverished masses in Iran. The fabulous profits from oil had not filtered down to them.
In 1979, Iran has its revolution.
Khomeini wasted no time declaring his vision for Iran. There would be no Western-style democracy, no socialist republic. We want Islam, he said. Only Islam.
Under him, Islam has become established throughout the country. Islamic laws dictate how individuals dress and behave. They are applied in the courts and in commerce. In Iran, Khomeini has created the only theocracy in modern times, and the masses accept this without question.
So suddenly now you have a competition between the Sunni Muslims of Saudi Arabia and the Shia Muslims of Iran over who is the right heir to the Prophet Muhammad's message, and they're competing. And because you had these revolutions, it caused oil prices to go up, so they have more money than ever to export these ideas around the world. And to top it all off, Three Mile Island happens. So we have a meltdown of a nuclear reactor in the United States that ends America's nuclear project. We never build another nuclear reactor after that. So we become even more dependent on oil.
So the royal family in Saudi Arabia, unnerved by the response from Islamic militants to perceived Westernization, swings wildly in the other direction to fundamentalism. That's exported. Iran has its revolution, and it too becomes a fundamentalist Islamic power. And where do you see all this going? What started in Saudi Arabia?
I blame them for 9/11.
Terrorists were receiving support in Saudi Arabia. 15 of the 19 hijackers recruited to attack our country on 9/11 came from there.
You guys put out these ideas that really shaped the ideology of the 15 Saudi hijackers of the 19. And then, of course, after 9/11, they said, we're going to fight terrorism, blah, blah. But what did they do? And the first guy who's been ready to take that fight to the extremists is Mohammed bin Salman. And this is so important because that right turn started from Saudi Arabia, and it can only be reversed from Saudi Arabia, the home of the two holy mosques. If this continues, this is huge.
And what could this restoration of Islam that the crown prince says he is working on do to change how Islam is practiced and viewed across the region and perhaps then the rest of the world?
Let's just start with women's empowerment.
Saudi Arabia is the only country in the world where women aren't allowed behind the wheel.
Women couldn't drive in Saudi Arabia. Now he says you can drive.
The religious police break up groups of young people playing music in public.
The religious police were on the street intimidating everybody. He got them all off the street. Some of the worst clerics, he arrested. When he does that, everybody else then has permission. So I got there on the Sunday before Thanksgiving, and holy mackerel, while I was sleeping, something really big had happened in Saudi Arabia. I have these young people telling me that Toby Keith had performed there on, I said, Toby Keith, a concert in Saudi Arabia? When did that happen? Never mind, they just announced that women can attend soccer games. That was banned. And suddenly they're telling me, yeah, now there's concerts all the time. There's films showing. And I start to realize that something very powerful had been unleashed. I knew they had let women drive. I knew that the system was opening up, that they had arrested some of the most radical clerics. Mm-hmm. But I didn't realize really how deep this had gone.
So obviously you think this is very positive, what's happening in Saudi Arabia under the crown prince. But what about these controversies that brought you to Saudi Arabia to talk with the prince in the first place? There were the arrests of dozens of members of the royal family and members of the Saudi business elite. And tell us about some of his foreign interventions.
He's done three major initiatives.
Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Egypt, and Bahrain cut ties with Qatar in June and imposed a land, sea, and air embargo.
One is he basically led an Arab boycott of Qatar for being too close to Iran and too close to Muslim Brotherhood movements in places like Gaza and elsewhere around the world that the Saudis are really opposed to.
Hariri's failure to return to Lebanon sparked rumors that he was being held in Saudi Arabia against his will.
Then in Lebanon, the Saudis engineered a kind of peace agreement in Lebanon de facto, where we have a Sunni pro-Saudi prime minister, Hariri, and we have a pro-Iranian Christian president named Michel Aoun, okay? And there was a balance of power there. But what the Saudis were saying is under that balance of power, Hezbollah, the pro-Iranian Lebanese militia Hezbollah, is basically taking over the country. So the Saudis get Hariri to come to Riyadh, and they tell him, you have to resign.
Saudi Arabia placed a blockade on Yemen last month after a missile was fired from Houthi territory towards Riyadh.
And the third initiative was a pushback in Yemen against the takeover of Yemen by the Houthis. The Houthis are a sort of Shiite offshoot minority who actually toppled the democratically elected government in Yemen. The Houthis are pro-Iranian. They're armed in part by the Iranians. And the Saudis said, we're not going to let that happen. It was an elected government. It was a pro-Saudi government. It was a government that we, the U.S., encouraged, you know, to be mm-hmm. elected and for the Saudis to support. And so Yemen's a complicated story. Yes, the Saudis have come in a very brutal way, bombing it from the air, isolating it, choking it off, creating mass starvation, you know.
Things that have been regarded as terrible atrocities.
It's a humanitarian nightmare.
So how do you reconcile all of that with what you learned on your trip?
Frankly, I'm concerned about Yemen, Lebanon, Qatar. I'm concerned about people being arrested in the Ritz-Carlton Hotel without any kind of transparency and due process. I'm concerned and worried about all of those things. But I know one thing, Michael. Saudi Arabia led the Muslim world on a right turn that affected the entire world of Islam beginning in 1979. Mm-hmm. And if Saudi Arabia is ready to right that turn, to bring Islam back to a moderate center, as this crown prince says publicly he is committed to do, that is huge. That is Berlin Wall falling scale event. Only a fool, only a complete and utter fool would predict success. But on that issue, only a fool wouldn't pray for his success.
Thank you, Tom. Here's what else you need to know today. A whistleblower's account, made public on Wednesday, says that just before Michael Flynn began serving as national security advisor, he assured a former business associate that the Trump administration would rip up economic sanctions imposed by President Obama against Russia, potentially allowing a business project he was once involved in to move forward.
I, Donald John Trump, do solemnly swear.
I, Donald John Trump, do solemnly swear.
The whistleblower, who gave his account to Democratic Representative Elijah Cummings, says Flynn sent an encouraging text message to the client from the steps of the Capitol as he watched Donald Trump take the oath of office on January 20th.
So help me God.
Congratulations, Mr. President.
The Times reports that the removal of the sanctions would have allowed Flynn's former client, an energy consulting firm, to work with Russia on a nuclear power deal, and suggests Flynn may have had a financial incentive to create a closer relationship with Russia. Anne.
There were new allegations today, and enough is enough. I mean, this is a conversation we've been having for a very long time, and it's a conversation that this country needs to have.
On Wednesday, after a sixth woman came forward with allegations of unwanted sexual advances by Senator Al Franken, much of the Democratic establishment called on him to resign, including dozens of Senate and House members, many of them women.
If you are a sexual harasser, go away. We don't want you. We don't want you as our colleague. You know, our interns don't deserve that. Our staff doesn't deserve it. The women members of Congress don't deserve it.
Franken, who has apologized for his behavior, has scheduled a news conference to discuss his political future later today. That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you tomorrow.